coaches know that the first minutes after halftime are a critical point in any game. Because athletes, like everyone else, have a tendency to start a game with force and then lose steam halfway through. Today on Truth for Life, Alistair Begg explains why this principle applies to our spiritual lives as well, especially when opposition comes our way.
I invite you to take your Bibles and we'll turn together to the book of Nehemiah once again, to chapter 4 and to the section which begins with the 7th verse. Last time we noted, indeed we said it was an axiom, biblical axiom, that whenever God's people do God's work in God's way, it will not go unopposed. Now that is something which we do not find simply in the pages of the Old Testament, although we do from the very beginning of God's dealings with his people, as they have been set in the context of enemies, the work of God has always been opposed. When you go into the New Testament, you find that this self-same is true. If we were simply to follow, for example, the life of Christ, then it is manifestly true, because at every point he was opposed in his journey and in his proclamation. When Paul wraps up his letter to the church in Ephesus, he does so with a stirring reminder to them of this principle. And in verse 10 of Ephesians 6, he exhorts them, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." And then he says it again, "Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground." When he writes to Timothy, who was a timid sort of young man, and yet who was to be entrusted with the responsibility of taking over in some measure from where the mighty apostle was leaving off, he says to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:3, "Endure hardship, Timothy, like a good soldier of Jesus Christ." And when, in writing to the Corinthian church in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he identifies the nature of his ministry in chronicling some of what he has been through, he says, "We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed." Tremendous realism which it attaches to Paul's perspective on ministry, and the same kind of thing we find here in Nehemiah. Now, this sense of realism is something that many of us need to come to in our Christian experience in the work of God. We face it in other areas of our lives, but perhaps are unwittingly naive when it comes to facing the peculiarities of the struggle in the work of God. In one other area of life, I came across this poem this week. It came out of the Nebraska Star in the 1930s. Actually, 1930 it was there. And it's called "Comfortless." It goes like this: "I found him underneath a tree. 'And what is wrong,' quoth I, 'that you so solemn seem to be under this summer sky? The birds above you gaily sing, the wild flowers brightly bloom. What is this awful, horrid thing which seems to seal your doom? Round you the children romp and play, the gentle breezes blow. Sad stranger, tell to me, I pray, the burden of your woe.' 'I do not see the sunbeams dance, nor hear the birds,' said he. 'There's something faulty with my stance. I can't get off the tee. All day I've shanked my mashie shot, my putts rimmed every cup. I'm doing something I should not. I think it's looking up. Poor man,' I said, 'tis very sure no help for you appears. The woes you bear, I tried to cure myself for 30 years. And still my mashie shots I shank, and still I slice the drive, and with the dubs expect to rank as long as I'm alive. Through time, all other griefs may cure, all other hurts may mend. The miseries of golf endure. To them, there is no end." I speak with a measure of certainty because, having had the privilege of going to speak at a Bible conference on the West Coast, you don't think that I was going to miss the chance to play golf. And so I went to play golf, thinking that maybe the gap of some 3 months or so would have introduced some miraculous cure while I slept. And I find myself reaching for my little red book to read the story of the fact that this is a grim and horrible task. And only the foolish or the foolhardy or the faithful are going to ever stick with it. Such is the Christian life. So what are we seeing here? We're saying Nehemiah was a realist. And if we're going to make it through our days doing God's work, we need to be as realistic as he was. We need to have the underlying conviction he had in order to fuel our zeal as his was fueled. What was that? Verse 20 of chapter 2 is the foundational element in his life. When the enemies came and mocked and attacked him, he said, "The God of heaven will give us success." It wasn't that Nehemiah was an egotist. It wasn't that Nehemiah was relying on his strategic plan. It was that Nehemiah was a deeply humble man who, on his own before God, on his knees, was trusting God to do what he himself was unable to do. He understood the words of the psalmist that we read in Psalm 127, "Unless the Lord builds the house or builds the wall, we labor in vain in our building of the wall." Subjected to ridicule, as in the first six verses of chapter 4, he stands firm. Like one who was to follow him, Bunyan, languishing in the Bedford jail, writing that great work of his, Pilgrim's Progress, and penning various other pieces of poetry at the same time. He pens the hymn, "Who would true valor see? Let him come hither." And one of the great verses that is usually exempted from hymn books today begins, "Hobgoblin nor foul fiend shall daunt his spirit." And that was exactly true of Nehemiah. He was surrounded, as it were, by hobgoblins and by fiends who were foul. The people that he was representing were despised. You will notice that in verse 4. "Oh God, we are despised." They were dependent. That's why they were crying out, "Oh, our God." And they were devoted, as you see in verse 6, describing them as people who worked with all of their hearts. Now, when you come to the 7th verse, it records the reaction of the enemies, who, upon finding that their ridicule has not worked, determined to call a summit meeting to consider the possibility of armed confrontation. So instead of the opposition diminishing, and we might have been tempted to suggest that Nehemiah faced ridicule, Nehemiah prayed. After Nehemiah prayed, it all died down and they had a wonderful time. No, after he prayed, it all hotted up and they had an even worse time. Now, that's a fundamental principle you see in our Christian lives. "Well, you know, the pastor said something and I prayed. And I thought that after I prayed, everything would be fine. But I've been praying for 3 weeks now or 3 months and everything's worse. The opposition is worse." You see, just after halftime in a sports event is a crucial time. At the start of the second half of the game, every coach knows that there is the possibility of making a strategic strike in such a way as to knock the opposition back, perhaps secure the victory, because there is some vulnerability that attaches to the halfway mark. And you will notice in verse 6 that the people were at the halfway mark. They had built the wall till all of it had reached half its height. And the opposition has intensified. We had Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs before, but now we've got the Ashdodites, the men of Ashdod. Prior to this, they were coming at them in a kind of three-pronged attack. They were coming from the north and the south and the east. With the men of Ashdod, they've now added the west. So they've got them completely enclosed. At least there was one point through the west, as it were, that they could all have run away if they'd chosen. But now they have got them snookered and ensnared with an enclosing circle of opposition. And Nehemiah faces a real challenge. Let me give you three words which continue our run of words ending in A-T-I-O-N. The first word is agitation. in verse 8. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. They were agitating. Now, it is unlikely that they were planning a full frontal attack, as it were, massing their armies and marching straight up to one of the gates of Jerusalem. The reason we might deduce that is because we know that the Persian king, Artaxerxes, had put his commitment and the strength of his manpower behind Nehemiah. And so any group that would have been tempted to attack would have to deal not simply with the people on the wall, but also with the might of the Persian king. Now, the fact that that would be an unwise strategy would never have prevented them from the possibility of guerrilla warfare. And indeed, guerrilla warfare was probably far more suited to this particular context, because after all, the people were scattered, as we will discover, all around the wall. And so it would be possible for them to marshal their attacks, maybe multiple attacks, at different points at different times, and thereby seek to bring down the project and to discourage the people. Because we shouldn't miss in passing that our enemy, the evil one, seldom comes right up the middle when he's attacking the work of God. His approach to most local churches is not to march, as it were, up the central aisle, challenging the exposition of Scripture. He's far too clever for that. He comes up the side aisles, sowing seeds of discord. He comes in the quiet places, he comes in the corridors and the apparently inconsequential conversations to sow disharmony and to dispirit and to discourage. He is expert in guerrilla warfare. He comes to the high streets of our towns and he doesn't open shops that say, to pot with the Bible and all of its truth. He's far too clever for that. He opens shops that have Bibles set in beautiful little treed areas with shining lights on them. And next to them, they have another book with a lovely shining light on it, so that the indiscriminate members of our society may walk up and down and say, my, doesn't that look like a lovely, cozy place? Doesn't that look like somewhere that I could find truth? After all, there's the Bible in there. They must be right on. The fact is, they're right off. Because if they were truthful, the Bible is subverted underneath the other book or is beneath the other book. And their conviction is that this Bible is not an inerrant book. It is not an infallible book. It is not a self-interpreting book. But the key to it is over here in this book. He's an expert in guerrilla warfare. He doesn't come and challenge so much the moral mores of our days outright, as much as he comes cleverly and quietly and subtly. And Nehemiah, having left and made this journey of 900 miles, having seen the project launched, having built the wall with the help of these people to half its height, now faces an intensifying of the opposition. Agitation. In verse 10, the agitation which is external is more than matched by the consternation, that's the second word, which is internal. At the halfway stage, the people are becoming overwhelmed. The sheer immensity of the task before them has now dawned upon them in a way that it hadn't done before. They're growing tired, and the word that is beginning to go amongst the people is this: we're never going to do it. We'll never make it. Again, the halfway stage is strategic. You clean your garage out, or your garage out. And you start to move all the stuff around some Saturday morning. You've got the average garage, which is sort of chaos. And then you say, I'm going to fix it. You start to move things, you take them down, you move them here, you move them there. You've got some in the driveway, you've some here, some over in a corner. So your wife comes out and says, would you like a cup of coffee? She looks at you. She doesn't say anything because she's trying to be kind. But she looks at it and says, she says to herself, he's never going to make it. I mean, all he's doing is moving stuff around. I mean, there's nothing clean. It's just all moved around. It's everywhere. I mean, you couldn't get a car in there if for love nor money. And you look at it and you say, I'm never going to make it. But if you stay with it, you will. I mean, you can just throw the stuff in the neighbor's yard or do something, but you can make it. You will make it. Now, in the case of the garage, the possibility is that you just start ramming all behind things and curtains and cupboards out of a quest for neatness. You see, you can be neat without being organized. I like neat. May not be organized. And my garage is neat, but don't open anything. Some ladies' cupboards in the kitchen are neat, but don't open them. At least open them and stand well back, because they got neat, but they don't get organized. And in that process, we may fail. But in this process, there was no potential for failure. And that's what the people needed to hear, and that's what Nehemiah had to bring to them. They're starting sitting around now looking at the rubble. There is so much rubble that we can't rebuild the wall. What do we know? There was no more rubble than there had been when they built the first half. Indeed, there was less rubble than when they built the first half. But their focus was gone. They had lost their vision. They had got off to a flying start, moving rubble, restoring the wall. They got to halfway, and then it began to paralyze them. The newness of the project had worn off. It can happen in a church in a context like this. All of the immensity that was involved with all the rubble of the past 7 years, getting to this point, coming through all of our days and all of our journeys, finally establishing something of a base that represents stability. And with the newness wearing off, people begin to get discouraged and disappointed. They lost their vision. They lost their confidence. They lost, as we'll see in a moment in verse 11, their sense of security. There is so much rubble. You see, you take the average young couple who are consumed with the project of this baby and the introduction to the world of diapers. It's so hard for me to say that word. We call them nappies. But anyway, into the world of diapers. And you talk to the young mom and she says, you know, diapers here, diapers there, diapers jolly everywhere. I mean, I just live in Diaperville now. And sometimes moms go into a measure of real deep discouragement. Somebody needs to come alongside them and say, hey, listen, remember what you're doing here. This is not about diapers. This is about this little girl or this little boy coming safely through these infant years and into maturity. Don't let your eyes get stuck with the diapers and lose sight of the vision of what you're doing. And that's exactly what was happening around the wall. The people were looking around and saying, it's just rubble everywhere. We'll never make it. So there was agitation outside, there was consternation inside, and furthermore, there was intimidation, which came hard on the heels of this internal lack of security. Verse 11, all the enemies said, before they know it, or before they see us, we'll get right in there among them, we'll kill them, and we'll put an end to the work. What you have here in verse 11 is essentially a whispering campaign. They were rattling their sabers, speaking of surprise attacks, immediate death, the resulting cancellation of the project. And so the word begins to go around. They're going to get us. They're going to kill us. They're going to shut the project down. Bad news travels fast. And there were a little group of people, some of them, living close to these enemies. You'll notice that there in verse 12. The Jews who lived near them. Principle, you get like the people you spend time with. If you live listening always to discouragement and to carping criticism and to the stories of failure and disruption and degeneration, that will be all that fills your mind. That will be all that comes from my lips. So you got to be careful in whose company you spend time. If you're prone to discouragement, don't live amongst people who traffic always in discouraging news. When you hang around people who are negative, you'll catch the bug. And the man or the woman who has jaundice eventually sees everything yellow. And what had happened was that the word that was coming through to these people who were closest to them had begun to permeate their thinking, and so they were coming to Nehemiah again and again and again. He tells us here that they came 10 times over to us saying, wherever you turn, they're going to attack. So there is the challenge to leadership. Agitation on the outside, consternation on the inside, intimidation outside, inside. What's he going to do? Verse 9, which we've jumped, provides us with the key statement in all of this. This is a fundamental, vital, biblical principle. But we prayed to our God, and we posted a guard day and night to meet this threat.
Nehemiah finds himself in a growing dilemma. The naysayers were relentless. You're listening to Truth for Life, a message from Alistair Begg called Hard Pressed But Not Crushed. Anyone in leadership can readily identify with Nehemiah's predicament. When disgruntled people hang out with negative people, their complaining gains momentum. If a leader isn't careful or if he's tired, he can allow their voices to creep in and cause discouragement. Christopher Ash is a pastor and an author. He's well acquainted with the pressures of ministry. He's written a helpful book called Zeal Without Burnout, 7 Keys to a Lifelong Ministry of Sustainable Sacrifice. And whether you're in vocational ministry or you work as a church volunteer, this book will coach you on how you can avoid hitting the wall. Christopher Ash provides a clear checklist of warning signs to help you avoid an emotional or physical crash before it happens. When you give a donation to support the Ministry of Truth for Life, we want to invite you to request your copy of the hardcover book called Zeal Without Burnout. This is the very last time we'll mention this offer, so call now 888-588-7884 or go online to truthforlife.org. If you'd prefer the ebook edition, you'll find it available online at truthforlife.org. Let me just say thank you for your donation today. Your support makes it possible for pastors and church leaders and others to freely access Alistair's teaching, either on radio, online, through our podcast, or by downloading our convenient mobile app. Again, to give a donation and request the book Zeal Without Burnout, call 888-588-7884. To stay healthy in leadership, it's essential to remember that God is far bigger than any problem or any criticism you might face. Monday, Alistair provides a biblical perspective.
We need to be singing the children's song. Our God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. There's nothing that He cannot do. The rivers are His. The mountains are His. The fields are His handiwork too. Our God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. There's nothing that He cannot do. Go out tomorrow morning, get in your car, pull it out of the garage, and you're facing the challenge of your day. Agitation from without, consternation from within, intimidation from all fronts. You want to live godly life in Christ Jesus. You say to yourself, it's so immense, I can't do it. Sing the song. Sing it to yourself as you drive across 480. Who cares what the people think? Be better than some of the sorry faces that are around you. Sing it out. Our God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. Careful on the hand actions. There's nothing that He cannot do.
Our study, called Hard Pressed But Not Crushed, continues next week. I'm Bob Lapine for Alistair Begg and all of us at Truth for Life, hoping you'll worship with your church family this weekend. Then join us again Monday to hear Truth for Life. Where the learning is for living.